Welcome, everyone, to Sublimely Austin, the podcast where two sisters discuss all their thoughts and feelings in regards to each Jane Austen novel. This podcast will contain spoilers, so if you don't want to know the ending of each Jane Austen novel, you should refrain from listening to this podcast until you have finished them. With that in mind, grab your book and your bonnet and join us in Regency, England. Hey guys, welcome to the second episode of Sublimely Austin. I'm Amy.
And I'm Holly.
And we are two sisters who decided to entertain ourselves and you during this pandemic's quarantine by rereading all the Jane Austen novels and talking about them. So how's your weekend been thus far, Holly?
Pretty good. Mostly was catching up on reading, Pride and Prejudice, starting the next one, typing up my notes, all that sort of thing.
Me, I did my notes quite a few weeks ago, but today was exciting because I learned how to video edit with Premiere Pro, and I edited my first book review of Midnight Sun.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so I'll post that up soon, and it's so cute because it has the raccoons crashing my video.
Okay.
So as mentioned in the last episode, we are going to cover each completed Austen novel in the chronological order that they were published, which means that today we are going to tackle the most famous of them all, Pride and Prejudice. So why do you think Pride and Prejudice ended up being the most famous one? Because I read it again and I'm just like, yeah, I like Sense and Sensibility better.
Yeah, I mean, I saw this somewhere the other day, but, I think it is a truth universally acknowledged that Pride and Prejudice is Jane Austen's most loved novel. It's kind of funny. When we were going to start doing this podcast, I wasn't that excited about reading Pride and Prejudice, to be honest, because I've read it so many times before. But then after reading Sense and Sensibility, I was really, really excited to read this one because, I mean, it's just so, I think there's a reason it is more popular. I mean, it's kind of funny. There's a lot of things that are really similar in it about, to Sense and Sensibility. You have your rebellious, female character who's taken in by a charming man while rejecting a more serious figure. It's kind of like the exact same setup, but there's so many things that are actually very, very different despite some of the extreme similarities. Just, it's more witty. I think it's just a little bit more fun. There's some themes in it that are a little bit different. So I don't know. I can see why it's more popular.
As with each episode, we are going to start off with story time because one reason that these books have lasted through the ages is because people find them so relatable. So we are each going to tell a little story or experience and how that reflects an instance in Pride and Prejudice specifically. So Holly, what is your story?
So I hope you're not too disappointed, or if this is, against the rules of the podcast, but
I don't think there were any specific rules.
Yeah, I mean, there were little scenes here and there that I could maybe pull some personal relation to. Like, for example, there's a scene where Elizabeth is telling Darcy, like, oh, it's no wonder you only know, like, 6 accomplishment women. It's actually a wonder that you know any at all because your standards are so freaking high. That kind of reminds me of I'm job hunting right now. So I read these job descriptions and it's like they want people who have experience in all these things, but someone with like barely any, it's like entry level, but they're looking for someone with way beyond entry level experience. So it's kind of like this person doesn't exist. Like your standards for who you want for this job are too high, So that kind of reminded me of that a little bit. But I mean, overall, mostly what I feel when I read this, especially when I read Elizabeth, Lizzie, she has some very key moments where she exerts her independence. And I feel like I wish I had done that multiple times in my life, and I haven't. So I actually feel like I don't have a lot that really relates directly to the story, but I love reading it because when she turns down Mr. Collins, when she turns down Mr. Darcy, and then towards the end when she's, defiant to answer the questions of, Lady Catherine, like all of those scenes, it's like, there are key conversations throughout my work life that, like, people were just not being great to my face, and I wish I could have maybe handled it differently. I'm more passive. I don't want to offend people. I don't like confrontation. But yeah, I wish I'd maybe handled it a little more like the way Elizabeth responds. And I didn't. So that's why I enjoy reading it, even though I can't really relate direct in terms of me. How about you?
Yes. Well, I had a very obvious example last time with Sense and Sensibility, my reason for why I love that book so much. With Pride and Prejudice, again, for me, it was a little harder, but I did have a little bit of a more concrete example. And I'm sorry if you're listening, Mom, but Mom, in some instances, could be a Mrs. Bennet.
That's really funny.
Well, it's just,
I didn't think about that at all, but I get you.
Yeah, well, again, like, you know, the dynamics between you and Mom and Dad and me and Mom and Dad, you know, are different. And I feel, especially when I was a late teenager, young adult, and the fact that I rebelled, and my definition of rebelling is not going into math and science like you did and what, you know, Mom and Dad wanted. And so, and Mom being really much more rigid of, no, you have to do it this way. And then Dad has to be the mediator, the Mr. Bennet who can see, like, okay, no, you don't have to do math and science.
Wow. I mean, were they really like that? I didn't know that.
Well, again, you were away at college at the time. So, you know, I just got, you know, they were getting older. And yeah, you know, that's how I remember it. And Dad himself has made some half-joking remarks that he always identifies with Mr. Bennet and Tevye from Fiddler on the Roof about being this guy where the only people he interacts with in his home life are women. So I know Dad himself feels like a Mr. Bennet from time to time.
That's really funny. You know, it's kind of funny because in terms of just Mom and how she deals with situations sometimes. Well, and again, this is kind of a difference between the books and the adaptations. So just to bring this up early, there's two adaptations that I watched to prep for this. Obviously, I think Pride and Prejudice has been adapted for screen, like probably the most out of all of them. But the ones I watched were the 1995, you know, adaptation that has Colin Firth in it as Mr. Darcy. And then I watched the 2005 version with Keira Knightley and Matthew McFadden. In the 1995 adaptation, Mrs. Bennet, I mean, she's a hoot. Like, she's just absolutely, like, neurotic. And that, well, again, apologies, Mom. I mean, that kind of reminds me a little bit of Mom. But in the book, I actually interpret Mrs. Bennet as not being quite that extreme. Like, I think they went really extreme in that adaptation. I mean, it's funny, but I actually read her a little bit more calm and just kind of calculating in the book. But yeah, that's an interesting example.
Yeah, no, I think that adaptation has colored my vision of Mrs. Bennet so much that when I read it, I just see that version.
Yeah, that's funny.
Oh, my poor nerves.
She does mention her nerves, but I just see her as being a lot more calm, I guess.
Yeah. So anyway, that's my own personal story time of how the biggest thing I think I can relate to in Pride and Prejudice. Sorry, Mom. So, alrighty. And yeah, let's just get right into it. We start off with, we don't necessarily have to go in chronological order of the events that happen in the book. I just have a whole bunch of notes. But definitely when I read it this time around, I remember the first time I read it, and I was like, oh, this is kind of nice. I kind of get why people like it. But this time I read it, especially after reading it compared to Sense and Sensibility, I kind of ripped it up a little.
Really? Because I actually really enjoyed reading it this time. So that's kind of funny. Okay, well, that's good, though. Now we have some opposing points of view, maybe.
Well, my first note is, why is everyone except Lizzie and her father an airhead? I don't like how we must tear the other sisters down to elevate our protagonist. Reminds me of the not like other girls mentality, which I abhor.
Oh, yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah, there was one moment at the beginning where, I mean, I will say again, we kind of maybe touched on this already. Mr. Bennet is part of what makes this book kind of very witty. He has some very great lines that I actually really enjoy reading. You know, I'm trying to find my notes on the description of his personality here.
Yeah, no, I just remember, let's think of happier times that I might outlive you.
Right, like he's very sarcastic.
Caustic.
Yeah, he's kind of cheerfully cynical in a way. Actually, that's another thing about the 2005 version. The father in that version, he's much more kind of despondent. He's definitely, the 1995 version, I think, captures the dad very well. He's kind of cheerfully cynical. But yeah, I mean, he teases his wife a bit. He likes his older daughters, but because he's kind of given up on his younger daughters, you know, he calls them silly. And it's kind of, it's not a great look for him to kind of have this attitude towards, you know, his family. But at the same time, I think you're supposed to interpret him as kind of good-natured in a way, like just very laid-back kind of guy. And he's not really being super mean, you know, he's just mm-hmm. poking fun. So I don't know, it does kind of strike a disappointing note a little bit. But yeah, I get what you're saying.
Yeah, and just like, I know it's supposed to be, you know, good-humored and natured, but humor is elevated to the point where it reads much more as a parody of real life than like, you know, the actual real life, you know, of the time, because the girls are so silly and because Mr. Bennett is so despondent, and then Mrs. Bennett is, you know, depending on how we interpret her, more neurotic.
Yeah, I think, again, it's also how we interpret the younger sisters as well. I mean, I think using a quote from much later in the book, I think Lizzie kind of reflects on the fact that they are very idle, ignorant, and vain. So, I mean, that could go many different ways in terms of character and, like, how it's, again, portrayed on screen is they're very, like, giggly and just, like, laughing all the time mm-hmm. and obsessed with the officers, which, that is a thing. In the book, they're very obsessed with the officers, but, you know, it could be played off very differently. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think we're supposed to interpret from Mrs. Bennett and all the description about the intel, I think we're supposed to interpret, you know, by Mr. Bennett's passiveness, that he is just totally given up. He's not going to have any sons, and just, it doesn't matter how he raises his girls in a way, because it doesn't matter how silly or how not silly they are, because they will never be able to inherit the estate.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, I think Mr. Bennett has some lines or speeches more towards the end of the book that do his character a little more justice. He doesn't force Elizabeth to marry just to marry, you know, Mr. Collins. Mm-hmm. At the end, he's also very concerned about her accepting Mr. Darcy. He kind of gives probably his best bit of advice in the whole book, which is, you know, are you really sure that you want to be doing this? I mean, I know you, and you can't possibly be happy if you don't, like, respect your partner. So, I mean, I don't think he's completely a horrible father, I guess, but, there is a part, too, where he kind of says, you know, we were gonna have a son, and we, like, just didn't end up saving money, and so, like, this is just what it is, you know? And the way he copes with that is just kind of by trying to make light of everything, which maybe that's a good thing, maybe that's a bad thing. I mean, it seemed to be a good thing for the case of Jane and Lizzie, who turned out fine, but not so much a good thing for the others.
Yeah, and what is it to be said that the older daughters remember when they had more resources, that there was still the hope that there'd be a son, but then as more girls came, it just, you know, all fell by the wayside.
Yeah, maybe. Like, they kind of just gave up on schooling the children.
And then, going off of my note of why do the other sisters have to be such airheads to prop up Lizzie, I have here, what is so bad about Mary? What is so bad about Lydia? It suggests that both sides of the spectrum are worthy of ridicule. Because Mary is the opposite. She's very studious, she reads, and is, I think, the most religious of the sisters. And so, but that is portrayed in a very negative way. And then we have Lydia, who's the most exuberant, most socially inclined. And that's portrayed in a negative light as well. So it's like both spectrums are bad.
Yeah, this is actually one of the key things that makes it very different than Sense and Sensibility. So in that one, it kind of props up Eleanor as her conduct being the right way to be, right? In this one, it's kind of calling out in a couple ways that maybe that isn't the best mode of conduct, is to just be very reserved and calm all the time. So, for example, like you said, you compared Mary and Lydia. So Lydia, obviously is very wild and, you know, to use the phrasing, and just kind of marries spontaneously out of pure whim or passion or whatever. Mary, well, I guess if I also pull into this example, Charlotte makes she marries Mr. Collins purely for a pragmatic reason. She's not in love with him. She's not romantic. And the book does kind of mock both those decisions as not the best decision. Like, purely passion or purely prudence, like, neither is kind of the best. You kind of need like a mix of both. And yeah, going back to Mary, she's very rational and she quotes her little, you know, words of wisdom that she gets from books and stuff, but that's kind of set up as making her look silly in a way, in her own way. So yeah, it's definitely a different vibe here, where it's like, it's more just like independence of thought is very important, and like being able to balance, I get all, I was gonna say sense and sensitivity, I was trying to think of some different words, but it's more like, I mean, it's kind of just relying on both how you feel, but also being able to judge situations correctly.
Yeah. So what do you have in your notes?
So, I mean, a lot of my notes are just chronological. One thing I did want to point out, just kind of as an overall theme. So I was reading some of the commentary. So my book has, you know, some commentary in the front and the back of it.
Right.
So I was reading that and I pulled out something interesting. So there's a theme in this book, or not so much a theme, but I mean, it comes up again and again. So the use of pictures and or portraits. So the word picture is actually used quite a bit in the book. So like, even just in sentences like, oh, she pictured that this and this would happen, you know, stuff like that. But also a lot of talking of portraits from time to time. So for example, when Darcy and Lizzie are dancing at the Netherfield Ball, they have a conversation where Lizzie's, you know, trying to make out his character. There's phrasing used like, you know, I'm trying to get a portrait of your character. And then like at the end of the conversation, Darcy says something like, please don't try to sketch me out right now. I don't think it would do either of our characters justice. So there's a lot of just talking about pictures and portraits and like basically appearances. Like, that we craft these pictures, basically, in our minds, based on appearances of what things are. And this is, like, the whole theme of the book, right, is being prejudiced. So the idea is that you should need to be very careful in what kind of portrait or appearance that you kind of craft in your mind, because it could be wrong. So I thought that was interesting. And then another thing that kind of plays off that a little bit, or is a nice parallel to that, is that there are a lot of letters in this book. So
there are a lot of letters.
There's 44. I mean, this is what the commentary said. There are 44 letters, specific letters, aside from just, you know, anytime non-specific correspondence is mentioned. And so the letters are really a counterpoint to the whole theme of appearance, because letters obviously relay factual information that someone is telling you directly. So I thought that was kind of an interesting thing that I never really thought about it when going through the book before.
No, I did. That did not even cross my mind, but it totally makes sense that we have all these emphasis on appearances via a portrait, but letters are quite private and intimate and, you know, show the true reality of things that isn't necessarily shown to the world.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, that's kind of a big part of the book. So yeah, but I mean, other than that, a lot of my notes are kind of written out in chronological. There are some very conversations that sometimes are very hard to understand, because some of the ones that happen between Elizabeth and Darcy, where she's basically just trying to tease him because she finds him just kind of a ridiculous person. Sometimes it's a little hard to, I honestly will have to reread them just to make sure I really understand like the point or the joke that she is actually trying to make. So there's a few conversations like that, but obviously as you go through the book and you get these kind of, again, rejections over and over again from Elizabeth, these sort of denials, it kind of just really points to her, you know, extreme independence. Like, she's not going to be guided by any sort of, I mean, she has good manners and that sort of thing, but, you know, she's not just going to adhere to social norms and be compliant, I guess.
Yeah. Speaking of Darcy, you know, as Darcy and Bingley start to interact more with the family, this time I paid more closer attention to Bingley's sister, and Caroline Bingley is trying way, way too hard.
Oh my gosh. This is what makes me sad about the 2005 adaptation. So, as you know, the 1995 one, Caroline Bingley really is kind of in the forefront, but I mean, she's much more an involved character, and just kind of watching her trying to, like, get in Darcy's good graces is just, it becomes really painful at times. Like you said, she's trying way too hard to get this guy's attention, and he is just not here for it. And that is something that is completely left out. I mean, there's one part in the Keira Knightley version, but yeah, I mean, it's great. It's actually another bit of humorous, you know, shenanigans in this book is watching Caroline Bingley.
Notice me, notice me, notice me.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I mean, that's pretty good. She's pretty funny. And then, of course, I mean, we didn't really, if we go through the plot, we can talk about characters, but, you know, she has a sister as well. There's another Miss Bingley who's actually a Mrs. Hurst because she's married.
Yeah, because she's married.
But yeah, Bingley has two sisters.
And what do we think about how responsible was it for Mrs. Bennet to make Jane travel in the rain and possibly get pneumonia?
Oh my gosh.
Just to have an excuse to stay with the Bingleys, especially in the context of the author, you know, having this whole thing where Marianne nearly dies from such a excursion.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. I thought that alone is very odd. I mean, not odd, but just, like you said, in Sense and Sensibility, Marianne being out in the rain and getting sick becomes a very, very serious situation. And here, it's like, oh, yeah, Jane has a cold. She has to stay there for a little while, but she's fine. You know, it's just kind of very drastically different from book
to
book.
Yeah, just the entire tone between Sense and Sensibility and Pride and Prejudice, I definitely felt it because I don't think I read them subsequently, you know, the first time I actually read the books, and this is the first time I, like, read them in a row, and so it was a much greater, starker contrast.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, this one, again, it's kind of interesting that you said this time you kind of were not as big of a fan. And I was just really relieved to read this book after Sense and Sensibility.
After the melodrama of Sense and Sensibility?
Yeah, because, you know, the way Sense and Sensibility ends, I mean, they end up married, but we can talk about this when we do the themes at the end, but it's just so much more satisfying in this book, the end, because, you know, in Sense and Sensibility, you do have a very formidable older woman, you know, head of a family, Mrs. Ferris, who's kind of a character that is going to forbid any kind of association to her family or to her sons of these other women who have no, you know, fortunes. But in this book, I mean, Lizzie directly confronts Lady Catherine. And I would call it the climax of the book. I think some people consider Lydia's elopement and running off like the climax. But I feel like this conversation with Lady Catherine just really kind of, it's so satisfying to see mm-hmm. Lizzie just kind of rebuff all of her ridiculous questions. Yeah. And then she ends up with Mr. Darcy anyway. So, you know, I think that's also why it's also popular.
True. Again, with all of Jane Austen's books, but especially Pride and Prejudice, I think because of the start, the very presence of Lady Catherine, you know, just the idea that women and society in general is starting to think about, you know, what are the merits of marriage via pragmatism and also affection and all those things. And, you know, they're at war with each other over what is appropriate and what is not. We've got this clash of classicism and then romanticism. And then my next note is, Mr. Collins.
Mr. Collins.
So Mr. Collins is their cousin, and he comes, and he is the vicar of Lady Catherine's parish, basically.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Huntsford.
Yeah, so he comes and he thinks that it's going to be really easy to marry one of the girls and, you know, tie up the whole issue with the entail nicely. Not that there's really an issue for him, but he thought it would be the easiest way to secure one of the daughters as his wife.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. I mean, he's played off in the adaptations as a very kind of ridiculous and bumbling type of character. In the books, he's much more formal and grave. I mean, he's still kind of ridiculous in that he's, I'm looking for the words here, pompously servile and sanctimonious. So, I mean, he's definitely kind of an absurd person, but he's very polite. He's very serious. Yeah, I mean, I just see him a little bit differently. Yeah, I lost my train of thought.
So,
not sure where I was going with that.
No, I'm just thinking, in my note it says, you know, this idea still exists in men today that no means yes. So, of course, the whole thing where Mr. Collins thinks it's all settled, that Lizzie is going to say yes, and even when she says no, he's thinking she's just being coquettish and coy, and she's like, no, I'm really serious, and he just keeps pushing it. And it just reminded me about, again, I told you the story of my own Willoughby in my own life, and there were a few instances where he said things and did things that made it very obvious that he did not take what I was saying like seriously, and thought that he could wear me down to create a situation and casual relationship that he wanted, and I'm just like, nope.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the thing about Mr. Collins is that, I mean, even after Lizzie rejects him and stuff, he actually is not so terrible. Like, I'm trying to see where I have my notes. I mean, he does say after she rejects him, Mr. Collins is very unhappy, but he very condescendingly apologizes. He really was trying to do a nice thing in a way by asking one of the daughters to marry him. And in fact, when Lizzie is like, you know, still refusing, and Mrs. Bennett is kind of like, you know, all flustered and trying to like fix the situation, I believe Mr. Collins says something like, you know, maybe we shouldn't force her into accepting me if she really isn't interested. I mean, if she's not, it sounds like her temper wouldn't suit my felicity. So, I mean, it's not quite as, he thinks he's doing a very nice thing, and he's not, I mean, the speech is very bad, you know, he doesn't love Lizzie. He goes into all the pragmatic reasons about why it would be a good thing for them to marry, and before I run away with my feelings, you know, like, it's kind of silly. And again, I don't think he's trying to be a jerk, but he literally thinks that she is just trying to play hard to get for some reason, because he can't comprehend that anyone would refuse this offer.
Yeah, I guess, again, I guess there has to be a degree of historical forgiveness, because I think it's a more modern interpretation that he's trying to do something nice, but from our modern standpoints, he's going about it in a very sanctimonious way that completely highlights the imbalances of power in regard to the entail and all of that jazz. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the kind of the worst part of this whole speech is when he says, you know, it's not likely that another offer will ever be made to you. I mean, that wasn't really a necessary thing for him to have said.
No,
that kind of makes him, I mean, that in particular makes Lizzie very, like, at first she's just kind of embarrassed because she, like, doesn't want to hurt his feelings. Or, I mean, I guess not wants to, doesn't want to hurt his feelings. She's not really angry at first, but that makes her angry when he says that, because it's very rude.
Yeah. One note I have is all this talk of the entail. So I didn't look up my history. I don't know when women truly started to inherit again, but even a century later, when you look at Downton Abbey, the same problem occurs where there are no sons and the entail, you know, goes to the however many times removed cousin, Matthew Crawley. Mm-hmm. So it's just interesting that this wasn't resolved, this whole issue of female inheritance didn't change or reform until like over a century later, and yet it's the commentary on this book is so heavy about it. So heavy to the point that you think it, one would think that it was like a really, really hot topic that was like changing politically at that time, but it didn't change for quite some, a long, long time.
Yeah, that's interesting. Actually, I was looking this up. So Mr. Bennett has 2,000 a year, I think, is the Longbourn estate, which is actually the same as Colonel Brandon.
Yeah, it's not outlandish, but it's decent.
Yeah, like, it's actually pretty decent setup that they have.
Yeah, and Brandon was the wealthiest, except for, with the exception of, like, John Dashwood's side of the family. Like, of the people that Miss Dashwoods meet, like, Brandon was the most wealthy out of all of them.
Yeah, I mean, the Bennets are, like, the principal family of the village. Like, their estate is Longbourn, and, like, it's the village of Longbourn. They're like the principal inhabitants of this tiny village, and then they're 1 mile from Meryton, which is like a little town. So they're actually, you know, a pretty well-established family. I mean, if you think of like Emma, how her family is kind of like the most highly ranked established family in the near vicinity, that's kind of like their situation pretty much, which I'd never really thought of before. Actually, one thing I like and don't like at the same time about the movie, the 2005 movie, is that they really make it a lot more rustic. The home, the outfits mm-hmm. they're wearing, the public assembly dance thing in Meryton is a lot more, again, like rustic. People are just a little more like disheveled. You know, they're like jumping around the music. I actually really like it visually, like for a movie, but it's kind of all off. It's Regency era.
For the decorum of the time.
Yeah, the outfits are off, actually. And like the 1995 version is probably more accurate of what that Meryton ball or assembly actually looked like. But yeah, so I mean, they're the principal family in the area. So, you know, they're doing okay. But again, they don't have sons. So, and another thing, I don't know if this is like a big major point to make about this book in terms of the times changing a little bit in one sense, but there's a lot of mention of kind of, there are more people in trade in this book. So mm-hmm. like Mr. Bennett he has this nice home, a relatively nice home, but he's not military and he's not, he's a gentleman, but he's not like part of the aristocracy. Like he's not a baronet or anything. And then like his relations are all, you know, like Mrs. Bennett's family is not very wealthy. Like her sister is in Meryton and married a lawyer. Her brother, so the Gardners, so Mr. Gardner and then Mrs. Gardner, Mr. Gardner is in some kind of trade profession,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, he's a merchant.
He's a merchant of some kind. But I mean, they're very well, you know, Darcy is very nice to them because their manners are like so good. So it's kind of like, and then Mr. Bingley even, I forgot about this, but Mr. Bingley doesn't buy Netherfield. He rents it. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not his family estate. He has some money, and I think Bingley's background, like, his father is also from some sort of trade background situation, and then he just has enough money to rent this property. So there's actually a lot of, you know, like I said, the upward mobility of like the professional merchant type class, which is something, I guess.
Which is, again, this is Regency, so the kind of early end of the industrial period.
Yeah.
So yeah, so going back to Mr. Collins, I have a question. Like if we try to make Mr. Collins a little nicer and said he was just trying to, you know, help out the family, if Lizzie said no, why didn't he go for Mary? She's the far more studious and religious sister. And I interpreted as such that he didn't think that any of the younger sisters were pretty enough for him. So that kind of makes him less sympathetic, that he was just trying to do a nice thing at the time period, and that he only deemed Jane and Lizzie suitable purely based on their looks. And those options were gone, he just hightails it.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's also said that Charlotte isn't necessarily super pretty either. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's definitely hinted at, I think, in the books and even visually in the movies a little bit, that like Mary maybe kind of sympathizes with him or likes him a little bit. But Mary just isn't given much time as a character in general.
Yeah, one of my book club ladies, like, told me she read 70 plus years, of course, after Jane Austen's death. So there are quite a few people who have written certain like fan fiction-esque novels. And one of the ones she read was an entire novel about Mary Bennett because she got no time on the page or screen whatsoever.
Yeah, interesting. I'm not sure. I mean, again, I will say actually that I don't think Mr. Collins is that nice of a person. I mean, I think he was trying to do, you know, what was kind of his duty or was proper. But yeah, I agree with you. I think he only went for the more attractive sisters and then was so kind of put out that even though, guess, Charlotte is not supposed to be, you know, she's more plain, I think is how she's described. But he was just so put out that like he was not going to make any other offers to that family. So, mm-hmm. you know, he went and proposed to Charlotte, And Charlotte had also been, you know, kind of, I don't mean to make her out as like scheming or anything, but she had been like talking to him, and in the book there's like subtle points where she was like being very attentive to him. I mean, you know, probably just to be nice, but you know, I don't know. And then later when Lizzie visits Mr. Collins and Charlotte in Kent, Mr. Collins makes a big deal about showing them the house and how lucky their situation is, and kind of just pointing out, like, subtly, this is what you missed out on, so I hope you're happy, is kind of, like, the whole vibe he's given off. So, yeah, he's definitely not a great person. And then, I mean, it's almost like he starts out kind of, I mean, he's not a desirable just person or personality to be around, but he's not, like, terrible. And he just kind of gets worse and worse. He kind of rubs it in Lizzie's face subtly that, you know, they're so happy. He and Charlotte are so happy. And then later, when, like, Lydia's elopement happens, he sends an awful letter being like, oh, how horrible. Who would connect themselves with such a family? Your sister's death would have been better. Also, I think there's even another letter, like, warning, like, when the rumor about Lizzie being engaged to Mr. Darcy goes around, in addition to Lady Catherine coming to, like, have the rumors dispelled.
Yeah, the letter comes as well.
Yeah, he sends a letter, which, again, I know the dad's not, like, the best, but I mean, he's almost kind of like a fun uncle in a way. He thinks this letter from Mr. Collins is hilarious and like shares it with Lizzie, because he doesn't know that Lizzie actually likes Mr. Darcy at the time. But
right,
he's like, isn't this hilarious that this crazy, ridiculous guy thinks you're engaged to like a person that you absolutely hate? You know, like he thinks it's a great joke.
So, yeah, we touched upon, you know, Charlotte. So what do we think of Charlotte's choice?
I don't blame her, but, you know, I mean, I think I'm kind of Lizzie's point of view. So, I mean, the man is kind of not great as a partner. Charlotte's older and is worried about not even getting married. And I think it's clearly described at one point, not Mrs. Bennet says that Charlotte isn't just plain. It's that, well, Mrs. Bennet points out that she has raised her daughters differently. And what she's basically saying is that, you know, at Longbourn, they have servants. And the daughters don't, like, work in the kitchen or anything or do housework. Whereas Charlotte, like, that's her family situation. Like, she does do, like, menial labor a little bit. So, you know, she's not as well established. So Mr. Collins is actually maybe a bit of a step up for her. So, I mean, and she seems really confident in her choice. So, again, bringing back the movies, in the 2005 version, there's this, I actually like it in the movie as a scene. You know, Charlotte basically tells Lizzie, you know, don't look at me like that, don't judge me. Because she is kind of embarrassed or insecure about the choice she's made out of necessity. But in the books, she's very confident. She's like, I am perfectly happy with the choice I have made. I'm very lucky. I'm going to have my own home. Like, she has no issue with this at all. And I think that, more than anything, is what makes Lizzie very disappointed. And, like, mm-hmm. they can never have the same friendship that they had before, just because of, you know, I mean, you could think of it as mercenary, I guess.
I think in the wider commentary, I think Jane Austen, you know, portrays this stuff that she's not totally condemning Charlotte's choice, but definitely making a comment upon it through Lizzie's, like, reaction to it that certainly wasn't unheard of for the time. And it makes sense for certain people, but still, like, not trying to, like, condemn it too much, but still, like, maybe there's another way to go through life.
Yeah, like, it's just, it's one of those things where it's, like, it's unfortunate that you would have to maybe make a sacrifice because of the way things are set up. And actually, just something to say, you know, kind of related to, so we have obligatory clergymen as one of our, you know, categories.
Yeah.
For Austen Meter. And I was sort of thinking about that the other day, and I was like, why is that even like a worthwhile category? Like, why does that kind of ring true as a scoring metric? And I think the reason is, like, the life of a clergyman's wife is really kind of the perfect baseline or frame of reference for, like, what a truly middle class, comfortable living would look like in that era. Mm-hmm. You know, you weren't a member of the aristocracy, or even the lower gentry, if those are even different things. I'm sure there's people out there with history degrees who actually know how to refer to these people. But clergymen were considered very respectable. They were often very well connected because they were giving a living by someone who was very wealthy. So they were giving the parish living that was, you know, associated with an estate. So they usually had a direct connection to the wealthier family that owned the estate, and the clergymen themselves often came from upper middle class or lower gentry families, but they were like maybe the third or fourth son or whatever, that didn't have their own like enough inheritance set aside. So, I mean, they were very educated. So Mr. Collins is, you know, he's not only the heir to Longbourn, but he's a potential suitor. When her friend marries him, it kind of is thrown in her face that, you know, she rejected what could be considered the minimal benchmark for standard of living. She basically gave that all up. So, you know, Charlotte accepts that opportunity.
Yes, she does. And so you touched upon it. They go to visit. Do all the sisters go? Is there just Jane and Lizzie or to visit Mr. Collins?
So what happens is Jane goes to London.
Yeah, right, right. Jane goes to London.
Jane goes to London, and then both Liz... So Charlotte invites Lizzie to visit because Lizzie's her friend. But along with... So her father goes, Sir William Luke, and her... Charlotte has a sister named Mariah who also goes.
Oh, right, right, right. And so it's here that we finally get to visit Rosings... Was it Rosings Park?
Rosings Park.
Lady Catherine's seat.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so, and here we also run into Mr. Darcy again.
Yeah. So, I mean, I feel like we haven't really talked about the evolving perception of Mr. Darcy. You know, we haven't gone through the plot really so much, but, you know, I mean, at this point, she's still not a fan of Mr. Darcy. She's seen him, you know, around Longbourn and Meryton and at Netherfield, and all she knows is what Wickham has told her. So yeah, her opinion of Mr. Darcy at this point is still kind of like, yeah, he's kind of a proud jerk who did this bad thing to this guy, like, supposedly.
Yeah, that's her impression of the time. And what my note says, you are the company that you keep, which is Darcy only engages with Lizzie in a positive manner, and Rosings Park went away from her ridiculous family.
Yeah, that is true. Like, it's kind of funny. Again, we didn't really go through... I have a lot of notes that are in chronological order, so I'm kind of jumping around my notes here as we jump around. But there are points where, as much as she dislikes Mr. Darcy, there are points where she is embarrassed at what Mr. Darcy thinks. Because even though she doesn't like him, unquote, she is very aware of how badly behaved her family can be at times. So she's, like, embarrassed at how they're making themselves look in front of him. Even though, technically, if she didn't like him, she shouldn't care. But she does.
Yeah, it's that you don't want the person you don't like to be right. And when she sees how ridiculous her family behaves, especially that one ball where Mary completely sings off key and does that horrible song, she's just like, Darcy has a point.
Yeah, I feel, I mean, I want to get back to this Rosings part because it's kind of where some of the more interesting conversations start to happen. But do you mind if we just to gather my thoughts, go through maybe quickly, chronologically, the book a little bit?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Okay, so I mean, we start at Longbourn, the family. I mean, we've talked about the family and what they're like already. Mr. Bingley arrives on the scene with his sisters and his friend, Mr. Darcy. The Meryton Assembly is kind of an important... It's actually very short in the book, but in the movies, in the adaptations, they make this part much longer, which makes sense to me because there's just a lot of conversations that happen in, like...
Yeah, a lot of introductions that need to... It's a pivotal scene that when you have to adapt it to screen.
Yeah, there. I mean, there's a lot of dialogue that is in the book. It's just not technically in this scene, and they move it to here, which is actually a good choice, I think. So yeah, so at the ball are Mr. Bingley, who is very pleasant, very unaffected, a really nice guy. Has a very inviting manner, and he takes a liking to Jane immediately. Mr. Darcy is there, and he refuses to dance. And Bingley is not so spineless as he is sometimes portrayed. he goes up to Darcy at one point and is like, stop standing around this stupid manor, which I think is pretty great. But yeah, he kind of slights Lizzie. So yeah,
she's horrible, but not enough to tempt me.
Right. So this is kind of what immediately sets him up as being a very proud and disagreeable man. So this is how he is viewed, not just by Lizzie, but actually by a lot of the people in the town.
Yeah, and again, our impression from Lizzie's perspective is that he's coming across in this way because, again, he's so much of a higher socioeconomic class than the rest of them that we presume that he's judging people based on that, when in reality it's because he's also like not taking the time to get to know people and is not realizing that, you know, these people just may have just as good or just as bad manners as anyone else. Like, we learn later, he likes to judge people based on their decorum and manners, which is why he looks at the other Bennet sisters with such contempt, but he's so nice to the gardeners later on.
Yeah, and jumping back to Rosings real quick, since that's what we were just talking about, he and Lizzie have a conversation here where she basically tells Colonel Fitzwilliam, his cousin, you know, about his bad behavior at this exact event. He came and he didn't dance with anybody or talk to anyone. And Darcy basically tries to tell her, I mean, it's a lot more eloquently put, but he basically explains, look, I'm kind of socially awkward. Like, I'm not good at talking to people I don't know. And she's a little bit harsh on him, like, oh, well, I mean, you just don't practice enough, which, I mean, is fair. He doesn't really seem to try to talk to people. And he does make that remark about her being barely tolerable, or, you know, not tolerable. So that wasn't great. So, yeah, and again, it's not just him. Because he doesn't dance with anyone, you know, no one thinks he seems like that great of a person. Yeah, and then I'm just looking through some of my notes. There's another party which isn't that important in itself, but Charlotte makes a kind of crucial observation here where she's telling Lizzie, like, hey, Jane, if she wants to secure Bingley, like, she's not showing enough, like, interest. Like, she's way too reserved and easygoing. Which, you know, Lizzie doesn't think that's that big of a deal. But later we find out that that turns out to be quite a problem that leads to a lot of bad decisions.
Again, doing a sort of contrast to Eleanor, where that was seen as virtuous, whereas in Jane's case, it complicated matters.
Right. Again, with the difference in the vibe of the books, this is not a good thing for Jane to, like, be hiding her feelings so much. Actually, I looked this up. It's called signal amplification bias, where if someone isn't animated enough, you think they don't care, which is a bad thing. I will say at this point, though, since we haven't talked about Jane at all yet, but Jane, I actually find her to be a very admirable character. I mean, she doesn't speak up enough, like, publicly for herself. But one thing that is good about Lizzie and Jane's relationship, unlike Marianne and Eleanor, they talk to each other and tell each other things. So Lizzie will go and tell Jane, like, what has happened, and Jane will do the same. So they're in each other's confidence, and Jane is actually very, her foresight, or not foresight, but a lot of times she will tell Lizzie, I know she's meant to be played off as naive sometimes, like, oh, Caroline Bingley isn't that mean. What are you talking about? She's perfectly pleasant. You know, I mean, she can be, but at the same time, she's quite wise. She will tell Lizzie, you know, look, we can't really conjecture about what the real situation between Darcy and Wickham is. Like, we probably don't have all the information. And Lizzie's sitting there like, you know, excuse me, but one knows exactly what to think about this situation. So, I mean, Jane is actually pretty, I don't think she gets enough credit for actually being very intelligent.
Well, I think it's the typical, she can observe others, but can't observe the things that are directly involve her. And I think it's also to the books, and they play it up to certain degrees in various adaptations, but where Jane is much more, Lizzie is so outraged by Charlotte's decision, whereas Jane is more, you know, you got to think about, you know, not everyone is the same, and, you know, people have different priorities and stuff like that.
Yes, she's much more understanding is the word for it. So yeah, so anyway, there's an ongoing thing with Jane and Mr. Bingley. So then there's the whole stay at Netherfield. So you brought this, you know, you brought this up where Jane is invited to dinner at Netherfield and Mrs. Bennet forces her to go on horseback so that she has to stay overnight if she gets sick. And then we get another kind of winning line from Mr. Bennet, you know, well, if it is a comfort to know that if Jane dies, it was all in pursuit of Mr. Bingley. yeah. So, I mean, Lizzie goes to Netherfield to be with her sister as well. The Bingley sisters aren't really a fan of Lizzie.
Or her muddy shoes.
Or her muddy shoes. Or her pert opinions. Or her conceited independence. Or, and, you know, all this nonsense that they say. Again, we get some very weird conversations between the party, you know, amongst the individuals while Lizzie is staying at Netherfield. So there's a lot of after dinner situations where it's Lizzie, Caroline Bingley, you know, Mrs. Hurst and Mr. Hurst, Mr. Bingley and Mr. Darcy. So we get that scene where, you know, they're talking about accomplished women. Darcy says he only knows a few. And Elizabeth kind of says, you know, oh, I wonder at your knowing that many. How can you know any? This is kind of a weird conversation to read. So I don't think Elizabeth is saying that she actually doesn't find women to be accomplished, you know. I don't think Elizabeth is mocking. I think she's mocking Darcy.
Yeah, she's mocking Darcy's opinion that that out of all the women in the world, only like a handful can possibly be accomplished.
Right. And actually, I like there's a follow-up. So when Lizzie isn't in the room, there's kind of a follow-up, which is kind of funny here because it's Caroline Bingley trying to put herself forward in Darcy's opinion that just goes horribly wrong. So Caroline says afterwards, like, you know, I mean, not quoting directly, but, you know, it's uncouth to put oneself down, you know, to make yourself appealing to the opposite sex. And Darcy says, yes, all means of trying to captivate and catch a man are despicable. And Caroline does not like this reply because it's clearly a slight on her trying to suck up to him all the time.
Right.
So I thought that was very amusing. Watching her these different evenings, again, is just very painful.
Yeah, I really like the actress who does Caroline Bingley in the 1995. Like, she's a very famous British actress. I forget her name.
Very famous. Forget her name. Yeah, yeah, I like her, too. I think she played the part perfectly. There's a part where Mrs. Bennet also visits Netherfield, you know, and Lizzie's a bit embarrassed by her behavior. But, I mean, we can kind of skip over that whole thing. Although, there is a little interesting moment here where, you know, Mrs. Bennet is embarrassed or, you know, gets offended by Darcy's comments about the country. But interestingly, Bingley, Mr. Bingley, is also slightly embarrassed about how Darcy says it, which is kind of interesting because, you know, it's, I know Mrs. Bennet's behavior is not the best, but it's kind of suggesting that Darcy's not on it being his best either.
Yeah, because he's just gotten a whiff of how silly they can be, and so he's just on full blast on being contemptuous of them. And again, a lot of people think it's from a socioeconomic class thing when more it's a decorum manners thing.
And then there's the other scene at one point where Caroline makes Lizzie take a turn with her about the room.
Oh, yes, that scene.
Which is pretty good. I mean, you know, most people know this scene, so I don't want to really go into it. But, you know, it kind of starts with a bunch of teasing banter, you know, witty back and forth banter. But it kind of really ends on a more serious, like, it kind of deteriorates finally until Lizzie basically tells Mr. Darcy, your defect is to hate everyone. And his reply is, well, yours is to misunderstand them. So they really don't like each other. Lizzie tries to play it off as teasing him, but I mean, she really does not like him.
They're half joking, but not really.
Yeah, right, exactly. So yeah, so then we have Mr. Collins arriving, which we talked about. Another interesting point here is at one point he suggests that he reads from Fordyce's sermons in the evening, which is specifically a conduct book for young women. So again, kind of going back to how this book is different than Sense and Sensibility, here this apparently like book of sermons for young women is considered highly boring and like not an interesting thing or worthwhile thing to be doing. But also around the time Mr. Collins arrived, someone else who we have not talked very much about arrives, Mr. Wickham. Yes, Mr. Wickham.
And Wickham, of course, Lydia is besotted with him as well as with all the other officers. But Mr. Wickham takes a particular shine to Lizzie Bennet. And they start chatting and they start getting acquainted. And Wickham can sense that Lizzie already has a disposition against Darcy. And he's like, ooh, I can use this to my advantage. And so he spins this whole tale about he was cheated out of his inheritance from Darcy's father, who basically took care of him. Yada, yada, yada. And this just solidifies Lizzie's pre-existing prejudice against Mr. Darcy.
Yeah, and she does not question any of it at all, which is amazing.
Does not question at all that this guy who she barely knows is relaying something so intimate and so delicate to her, especially during that time.
Yeah, yep. Prejudice.
Indeed.
So we talked about the Netherfield ball, and Wickham is not at the ball.
Yeah, because he's not going. He puts on this bravado, but at the end of the day, he's not willing to interact with Darcy any more than he absolutely has to.
Yeah, so Lizzie has to dance with Mr. Collins at the ball. He's not very good at dancing. And then she dances with Mr. Darcy. And, I mean, we don't have to go into details about this conversation, but I kind of brought up this whole idea of painting pictures and portraits of people, you know, whether literally or figuratively. Miss Bingley accosts Lizzie about Wickham at the ball.
Oh, does she?
Yeah, she pulls Lizzie aside and is like, oh, did you know Wickham is related to Darcy's family? He was the son of the steward. You know, by the way, he's actually not to be trusted. And this makes Lizzie very angry because she's like, you've accused him of nothing than of being Mr. Darcy's steward's son, and he told me of that himself. Again, Jane cautions being too quick to judge anyone's comments or to accept Wickham's innocence, but Jane's warnings go unheeded.
Like poor Cassandra.
Oh, and then this is very sad. So her family does many embarrassing things.
Yeah, this is the one where Mary sings and it's atrocious and Lydia and Kitty are just like, bleh!
Yeah, and Mrs. Bennet is talking very loudly about Jane's advantageous marriage to Bingley.
Yes, like a little jumping the gun, a little too quickly.
Yeah, it's almost like they're... Yeah, Elizabeth can't believe how mortifying her family is being, almost as if they're on like a mission to be as embarrassing as possible.
Yeah, so yeah, that's kind of the gist of... Now we're back to where we left off at Rosings Park. Because Lizzie, you know, Jane goes to London and Lizzie wants to get out of town to, like, you know, kind of have a breath of fresh air from all that has happened, both with her own family and with Darcy's and the Bingleys.
Right. So, I mean, Mr. Collins proposes after the ball, which we talked about. And then he marries Charlotte, and then, yeah, and then Lizzie goes to Rosings.
So one note I have about Rosings, of course, Rosings Park is where we meet Lady Catherine for the first time, and it's a very nice, from a literary standpoint, it's a very well-written, like, conversation, you know, between Lady Catherine and the others. And I have it in my notes, Lady Catherine de Bourgh brings up a good point. Mr. Bennet complains of the daughters for being so silly, but why didn't he provide structure to their education to curtail their silliness? He mocks them for their behavior as if he had no say in their upbringing.
Yeah, it's funny because the way you're supposed to interpret it, I think, is that Lady Catherine likes to be involved in everyone's business and grills Lizzie about her family and her upbringing and her sisters, and her being kind of astonished that they had no governess, that the younger sisters are out. So out meaning they are allowed to attend public balls and dances and things, you know, before the older sisters are married. Like, she's kind of shocked. And I think, I mean, I agree with you that she brings up some good points. I mean, she's very condescending.
Yeah, it's not coming from a good place by any stretch of the imagination. She's trying to prop herself up by condemning, you know, what she sees as subpar to a woman's education and trying to, because I don't know, we don't know exactly what Darcy has told Lady Catherine at this point, but is it Is she suspecting that Darcy may kind of like Lizzie as early as this, or?
I didn't get that idea. I think Lady Catherine only knows Elizabeth as the woman who rejected Mr. Collins.
Oh, yeah, true.
Because I'm pretty sure Mr. Collins probably told her about that.
Probably.
Yeah, so I mean, she's just trying to get a read on who this person could possibly be. But yeah, I mean, again, I think the point, and I agree with this point as well, that is sort of being brought up here, is that Lizzie is independent and she's a good person. And not having all these advantages, like a governess or whatever, have been a major hurdle for her bringing up. And she's just kind of, like, rebuffing all of Lady Catherine's, you know, very, I don't know how to say it, like, what she thinks a proper upbringing looks like. But, you know, she's not entirely, you know, considering how crazy and vain the younger sisters are, maybe she's not entirely wrong.
Again, it was okay when it was just Jane and Lizzie as the first few borns, but then as resources got stretched out, you know, that disadvantage started to show significantly more.
Yeah, I will also say that in both adaptations, Lady Catherine de Bourgh is a very very old woman and very formidable and kind of overbearing. In the books, though, like Lizzie says, she can see how other people can find her scary, but she wasn't really scared of her at all. I've always pictured her older, but on rereading the book, I kind of picture her as a, not like super young, but like a slightly younger woman, you know, like not Judy Dench's age.
Yeah, middle-aged.
Like, yeah, like maybe a middle-aged, like younger just woman who, you know, is very pompous and has her own opinions, but isn't like this incredible, like entirely dominating presence, you know what I mean?
Right.
But anyway, yeah. So I kind of see what you mean there, like being like, what? No governess, but you have five sisters. How does that work?
Right. So it is at Rosings Park that Mr. Darcy is finally able to get to know Lizzie a little better, again, away from her family, which was a
distraction.
Yes, a huge distraction to Mr. Darcy. And it's just kind of interesting that, you know, Darcy kind of has this double standard that he's willing to blame Jane for her family, but he doesn't blame Lizzie for her family. But that comes when, you know, after finally getting some time alone with Lizzie, Darcy finally decides that he is going to propose to her.
Mm-hmm.
And thinks that, of course, she's going to say yes, because who wouldn't say no to him?
And I think I have a quote here where, I hope this quote is correct, she stared, colored, doubled, and was silent. I feel like maybe I mistyped something there. But she is completely astonished by this.
Yeah, like she could not have predicted this at all. And, you know, was the quote like, do you expect me to rejoice in the inferiority of your circumstances?
Right. He basically insults her. I mean, not even on purpose, really, but he's just saying, like, I've had to fight against all these things. That's how much I love you. But she's just like, I'm sorry, but you'll get over it. And he's like, is that all the reply I get? So yeah, he doesn't present himself well.
No, and he suffers again from the kind of the Mr. Collins thing that he's, even though he's trying to be a little more sentimental about it, he's still operating from this pragmatic standpoint of course she would accept, and probably presumes that based on her mother, who was so obsessed with Jane's advantageous pairing with Bingley. So he thinks that all the daughters will be of a similar disposition in regards to marriage.
Maybe. I honestly don't even think he's thought about it that much. I mean, I don't think he's calculated like, oh, she must accept. I just think that he likes her and he's making this proposal and he's just not expecting what is going to happen. And she,
right.
I was just gonna say, so she brings up both Jane and Wickham in this conversation.
Yes, that's what I was gonna mention. So yeah, Wickham gets brought up and Darcy finally realizes, oh, that's partly why, you know, she thinks I'm such a scumbucket. And then also brings up the part about Jane where he didn't think Jane liked Bingley all that much and wanted to save his friend Heartache. And so in that way, he was truly a scumbucket.
Yeah, I'm realizing now we didn't technically clarify this at any point, but obviously if listeners have read the book, they know about this. But yeah, there is a point where Bingley and his sisters leave Netherfield. So they go away. And, you know, before Jane goes to London, part of her going to London is to maybe be able to run into Bingley. But basically the thinking before was that maybe Caroline Bingley had orchestrated, you know, removing her brother from vicinity so that he wouldn't end up marrying Jane. But what happens is Lizzie and Colonel Fitzwilliam go on a walk at some point where Colonel Fitzwilliam kind of, they're talking about Mr. Darcy, and he kind of relates this whole story of how he saved a friend from a very unadvantageous marriage recently. And Lizzie realizes that it wasn't Caroline Bingley who orchestrated this whole separation, it was Mr. Darcy. So we didn't actually technically talk about that.
Fred, I'm over spoilers. If people are listening to this, then they know the book.
Yeah, okay. So yeah, he separated Bingley, from Jane, he doesn't deny it. And when she brings up Wickham, he's actually very upset about this. Like, is this what you think of me? Like, yeah, it's not great.
Yeah, and immediately afterwards, I thought maybe there was a little more time or a little more action in between, but immediately afterwards, she gets the letter that explains everything about the relationship between Mr. Darcy and Mr. Wickham.
Right. So again, we go from appearances, like everything that's been based on appearances, to a letter which does explain everything.
And there is we learn that Wickham was a lazy piece of crap who didn't basically hold up his end of the bargain in what he had promised to Darcy's father, and finally got to a point where Darcy cut him off and Wickham tried to quote unquote salvage the situation by trying to elope with Georgina and get some of her fortune, but Darcy was able to kibosh that whole plan and has cast Wickham out, and so now Wickham is just on his own, you know, scrambling for himself in the regiment.
Mm-hmm. And Lizzie, just to move forward, ruminates over this letter and over Wickham's behavior and kind of realizes her errors very quickly. The impropriety of communications with such a stranger as Wickham, how he skewed, like, stated similar things while skewing them to his advantage, how Jane had suggested tempering judgment and she didn't listen. The whole town of Meryton kind of learns about Wickham's past treatment from Darcy, but only after the Netherfield family have left the area. He goes after Miss King, so at one point Wickham chases after this woman, young woman of fortune, and at the time Lizzie was like, oh, that's understandable, because, you know, he needs money. And now she's like, how did I not see how incredibly mercenary that is?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there is even, who was it, her aunt, like Mrs. Gardner, she was talking to about, and like they were in debate about like Wickham and his conduct and whether it was excusable or not.
Yeah, and Lizzie was very forgiving.
Yeah, and which is ironic because she's so forgiving of Wickham but so condemning of Charlotte for doing a similar scenario.
Right, it's kind of this question of when does prudence become mercenary?
Yeah. So finally, Wickham is revealed to be the scum bucket that he is, and Lizzie is invited by the Gardeners to join them in their little bout around the country, right?
Right. So, I mean, before that, I mean, just briefly, I mean, she tells Jane about the proposal, and she tells Jane about Wickham's character, and they decide between them to not make Wickham's character widely known, because the militia has actually been, like, since moved on from the area. Lydia's not in Brighton yet, is she? No.
No, not yet.
But Jane knows about Wickham's character, but they don't share it with anyone else.
Mm-hmm. So then Lizzie gets invited to go jot about the country with her aunt and uncle, Mr. and Mrs. Gardner. And it is through this visit that she actually gets to visit the seat of Darcy's estate, Pemberley.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So is it a Pemberley Park, Pemberley Hall, Pemberley Manor, or is it just called Pemberley?
I think they only refer to it as Pemberley. They might even call it Pemberley House at one point.
Yeah.
But it's more than a house, definitely.
Of course, but you know,
it has it has extensive grounds, and they do say like the park.
Right. And then, you know, the housekeeper shows them around, and the housekeeper is so affectionate when she speaks of Mr. Darcy. And this really surprises Lizzie, because, again, like, she's presuming that all of Darcy's stuffiness derives from, you know, class and socioeconomic status, when it's more so about, you know, people's personalities.
So, yeah, I have some notes here. So the housekeeper sings praises of Mr. Darcy as a landlord, which nearly breaks Lizzie's brain. also what's kind of interesting here, on thinking that people like maybe her aunt and uncle, so I mean, they're visiting this big house like the way you'd visit a museum, because that's how things were done back then, but they're not like you know, they're not like friends of the family. But so on thinking that people like her aunt and uncle in trade couldn't possibly be real visitors to the place, I have a quote here. This was a lucky recollection. It saved her from something like regret.
True.
And then another thing I wanted to say about Pemberley is, I know later there's kind of a joke when Jane asks, when did you start falling in love with Mr. Darcy? And Lizzie says, I believe it's when I saw the lovely grounds of Pemberley or something like that. But I mean, there's an interesting metaphor here, again, with pictures. So there's a miniature of Darcy that they look at, but there's a larger portrait of him in one of the private rooms. It's, again, this idea of not just a fancy house, but kind of peeling the layers of appearance away. So, you know, I mean, this is Darcy's home. So it's the closest thing you can kind of get to, you know, understanding who he is as a person. You know, you're kind of entering his world, so to speak, and hearing the housekeeper talk about him. So yeah, I mean, it's not just about seeing the like amazing house. It's kind of just about understanding like how many people are, you know, he is responsible for, and most people actually have a very good opinion of him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, they had deliberately, you know, Lizzie had deliberately tried to orchestrate, you know, visiting Pemberley when Darcy was not there, but of course Darcy shows up.
Yes, yes, this is the so I mean, in the book it's embarrassing enough. They're outside on the grounds. Darcy appears just kind of walking up early. He wasn't supposed to come back till tomorrow. I think they both blush, but his manner is very changed. He's very, like, much more polite, not more polite, but he's just a little more concerned.
Gracious.
Yeah, gracious, that's a good word for it. And she is very embarrassed about how it looks for her to be there. Of course, in the 1995 adaption, we have the famous, you know, Colin Firth, like, he goes for a swim first.
And he shows up dripping wet.
Yeah, so he's wet, he doesn't have his jacket on, so he's got, like, not all proper attire on. This is, like, the famous scene that everyone fawns over.
Right.
Which is, yeah, I mean, it's pretty good. I wasn't super excited about that scene, but I do like Colin Firth, so.
Yeah. And so, yeah, as we spoke before, Lizzie is shocked that he is so accommodating and gracious to the gardeners, you know, and so he decides to show Mr. Gardner, like, the fishing in the area, and that he's welcome to fish whenever he wants, and just is really nice to them, and she's trying to think, okay, he's not such a bad guy after all. But before she can dwell on that too much, she gets a letter from Jane.
Right. I mean, so there's some other things that go on here, like Darcy brings Bingley and his little sister, Georgiana.
We finally meet Georgiana.
So, I mean, that happens. We don't have to dwell on that too much. The Bingley sisters are also around because they're visiting. There's a scene here where Miss Bingley, again, starts criticizing and making fun of Elizabeth. And there's a quote in the book here, "Persuaded that Mr. Darcy liked Elizabeth, this was probably not the best method of recommending herself." And Darcy snaps at Caroline and says, "Lizzie's the handsomest woman of my acquaintance."
Yeah, or the most accomplished or whatever, and yeah, and just totally shuts her down.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, the letter arrives. Very, very bad news.
Which is that Lydia has run off with Mr. Wickham. Lizzie is, of course, devastated by this because she knows what Wickham is like, and she knows, and she feels guilty because, you know, her and Jane made the decision not to talk about it to anyone, but maybe if she had, then maybe this could have been avoided. But even though she didn't talk to anyone about Wickham, she had previously before she went left with the Gardeners. You know, when Lydia was invited to go to Brighton with that colonel's wife as her companion or whatever, she does try to appeal to her father and is like, do not let Lydia go. Like, she will be a disgrace. Like, she wasn't anticipating anything as intense as what truly happens, but just knew that if left unchecked, that she would just make a general embarrassment of herself and the family.
Right. I forget when she goes exactly, but yeah, I forgot about that. Lydia's invited to go to Brighton, where all the officers are located. And yeah, Lizzie cautions against it. Like, she says all these things, like Lydia's behavior, calls into question our respectability as a family, et cetera, et cetera. But the father, you know, Mr. Bennett, is just like, this is the only way she's going to learn that she, you know, is not as great or, you know, as she thinks she is. This is will teach her of her own insignificance, is what he says.
Yes. And yeah, so it's only, so again, it's just showing a very narrow and sanitary view of the world, that she could only be prey to someone if someone thought she had a fortune, not being prey that, you know, she has no fortune and would be completely taken advantage of.
So Lizzie reads this letter, because Mr. Darcy kind of interrupts her right when she gets it. She tells him, you know, the contents, and he's also, you know, very sorry and, like, you know, consoles her momentarily, but he basically kind of leaves very quickly. He kind of rushes off.
Because Darcy knows him better than most people, so he probably knows where his hiding spots are.
Yeah, he's already thinking at this point, like, he is going to go and try to find them. And what Lizzie thinks is happening is that now that this sort of misfortune has fallen on her family, that he's just gonna, you know, extricate himself from knowing her or anything like that.
Cutting off all association with her and the family.
Yeah, but what he's actually doing is, like, immediately going to see if he can find them.
Right, and of course, Lizzie returns home, and Mrs. Bennet's like, oh, my poor nerves, Lydia would never have done this if she was looked after properly, you know, blaming everyone except, you know, Lydia. Although, in reading this, I did have a note of, like, why do, you know, people condemn Lydia a lot for being stupid, but we don't condemn Georgiana for being stupid, so why is that?
That is an interesting point, because it's the same age, right? Georgiana is also 15.
Yeah, Georgiana is also quite young. She's Lydia's age, and I sort of interpreted it as because Georgiana is portrayed as very quiet and proper and more in line with what society prescribed for women. And Lydia is just so loud and obnoxious that even though their personality should have nothing to do with the fact that, you know, that they were preyed upon by this scumbag, that Georgiana gets the sympathy and Lydia doesn't.
I mean, I think the difference, and it makes all the difference in the world, is that Georgiana tells her big brother, Mr. Darcy, that she is going to do this, and then Darcy stops it from happening. Mm-hmm. And then I think you can imagine that even if it had happened, like, Darcy would have looked out for it. Like, he probably would have done the same, like, what he does for Lydia is pay for the wedding and make sure that's all kind of hushed up, in a sense. I mean, for his own sister, he would have just had to deal with it and made sure she was taken care of, I guess. But he, you know, he just outright stops it from happening. Whereas Lydia, we have very little sympathy because, I mean, first of all, there are many other officers that are mentioned by name in the book that Lydia's, like, she's, like, flirting with all of
them. Right.
And so, I mean, she's just kind of, I mean, she's excited about, she makes a lot of comments about, I'm basically, like, partying, you know, that era version of partying.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And stuff like that. So, I mean, you know, that's what kind of makes it less, like, we don't pity her as much.
Mm-hmm. So anyways, Darcy goes off in search of them. Lizzie goes home. Obviously, the whole family's into stress. And then finally, Mr. Bennet joins, you know, the uncle in London, also trying to find him. Lots of chaos. They don't know all of what's happening. But then it finally comes out. And during while all this is happening, as you mentioned earlier, Mr. Collins sends the condescending letter of sympathy to the family that the death of a daughter would have been less scandalous than what is currently going on. And only Mary seems to think that it's actually a genuine sincerity, like condolences, where everyone else, you know, thinks it's a bunch of hogwash.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so, but it finally comes out that they are located, and though they don't know this yet, that Darcy has been able to orchestrate, you know, everything being taken care of, and Mr. Ben is like, how am I ever going to pay back your uncle? Because there's no way that Wickham settled this for, you know, the meager amount that's originally stated.
Right. So Mr. Bennett actually does come back at some, he comes back to Longbourn while, you know, Mr. Gardner, their uncle, stays in town. So Mr. Bennett doesn't know about Darcy's helping this situation because he's not there at that point. They get a letter from Mr. Gardner saying, it's all settled. We found them. They will be married if you would agree to this, you know, providing this amount of money. But they're pretty sure, like you said, that that Mr. Gardner, the uncle, had to have shelled out a lot of money to convince Wickham to marry Lydia. But of course, we know it was Darcy.
Yeah. And so it is finally settled, and Lydia returns to Longbourn, and she is now Mrs. Wickham, and she doesn't think there's anything wrong with this.
Oh my gosh, her behavior is intolerable.
Yeah, no, like, again, Lydia's not the most likable character, but just this whole notion of Lydia marrying Wickham reminds me of the, like, marry your rapist philosophy, because, you know, they don't possibly think, oh no, you know, in modern times, oh no, he's such a terrible guy, we gotta get her away from him. Like, just the society rules and social structures and gossip for the time is like, there is no other option, she has to marry him now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And yeah, like, it, like, I remember,
but she is very happy about this.
Like, she's very happy, but I give her more forgiveness because she's a 15-year-old kid.
That's true. She's not gonna have a very happy marriage.
Yeah, no. And there's actually, you know, like a fan fiction sequel, like there's a movie called Death at Pemberley, which is like a murder mystery, like after Pride and Prejudice, and you
I've
see
heard
just,
of that.
It was actually pretty good. And and yeah, you know, she's not very happy with Wickham. So anyways, but yeah, just the whole, like, having to marry this one person, whether it's a racist or, like, you know, just you have to, after a relationship has been established, you have to marry them. This reminds me of, there was a huge scandal that sparked a lot of protests in Morocco, where in, like, the northern rural part, that, again, the same thing, where a, like, some sort of judge, you know, allowed a rapist to marry his victim to, quote unquote, salvage the situation. And there was just huge protests all over the country because women were sick of, you know, this mentality.
Yeah, that's pretty awful.
But yeah, again, same scenario, not thinking of, there's no way that they even consider Lydia's, you know, future happiness at this point. They just have to solve it right now, and Lydia's just going to have to live with it.
But she lets slip to Lizzie that Mr. Darcy was at the wedding, and Lizzie puts two and two together. Well, actually, no, she writes Mrs. Gardner for more information, I think, and
Mrs. Gardner spills the beans, and then Lizzie's realized, oh, he did this so nice for me after he thought my family was so bad.
So, right after this, I mean, Wickham and Lydia are off to another part of the, you know, country to live somewhere else.
With his regiment, right?
This is like too much detail, but there's a whole change of, you know, he's in the militia, which moves around. He, like, sells his commission and, like, joins the regulars, which, like...
Oh, yeah, because I have this in my note that Mr. Gardner makes an excellent point that, you know, this sort of scandal would have been just as damaging to Wickham and his regiment and his position within that regiment. So he probably had no choice but to go move somewhere else.
Yeah, yeah. So they're off. And then Bingley returns to Netherfield.
Yay!
And Mr. Darcy is with him. And, I mean, in the books, there's actually a lot of back-and-forth visits that actually happen, which are appropriately condensed in both adaptations to, like, a couple of visits. Yeah, but basically, Mr. Darcy, we know, feels bad for having separated Jane and Bingley, so he brings Bingley back. Say that five times fast. And
brings Bingley back.
And so Bingley's around. Jane swears to Lizzie that she's in, you know, not in any danger of feeling embarrassed or upset. But Bingley does come back to propose, and Jane is insanely happy. And gives, I do like that Jane has a little bit of growth in this book as well. A lot of the characters do change a bit over the book, unlike Sense and Sensibility. But Jane gives an unforgiving speech about Miss Bingley. You know, she thoroughly suspects her of not being on her side when it comes to, you know, her admiration of her brother. And Jane says something along the lines of, you know, Caroline will just have to deal with me being her sister-in-law now. Oh, I was just going to say, and during this conversation, Lizzie jokes that perhaps there's another Mr. Collins out there for her. Mm-hmm. There's Catherine de Bourgh.
Oh, yeah, Catherine de Bourgh. So after Jane becomes engaged to Bingley, well, the first there's the letter from Mr. Collins, like, suggesting this. And as you said earlier, Mr. Bennet, like, thinks it's hilarious because he thinks there's no merit in it, possibly, mm-hmm. whatsoever, in any way, shape, or form. But based on these rumors, there's a strong enough foundation that Lady Catherine feels the need to come and visit the Bennets. And in the 2005 version, they show it as if she arrives in the middle of the night.
Yeah, that's kind of weird. I mean, I think it's supposed to just enhance the fact that this is very unexpected, and she's just kind of stepping all over them, basically. But yeah, I mean, typically that wouldn't have happened.
Yeah,
in the book, she comes like in the morning or something.
Yeah, like she comes at a it's a shock in of itself that she came at all. Like, it didn't need the melodrama of being late at night with Mr. Bennet with the candelabra in his hand.
I've always questioned kind of, so the rumor is that she and Darcy are in fact engaged, and I've always kind of wondered where the rumor itself actually did start. Like, how did it get to her? And if I can't remember if Lizzie actually told Charlotte while she was there that Darcy had come and proposed.
I can't possibly remember.
Or if Charlotte suspected it, or I think Charlotte kind of suspected that Darcy, like, oh, I mean, that must be it, because there's multiple times where Charlotte says things like, Mr. Darcy would not be visited, you know, he would never come to visit, you know, me, you know, it must be because you're here. So I think through Charlotte and Mr. Collins, how Lady Catherine knows this potential thing.
Yes, and of course, very iconic scene where the banter between Lizzie and Lady Catherine, where Lady Catherine straight up demands, are you engaged to my nephew? And Lizzie says no. And she's like, do you promise never, you know, enter into such an engagement? And Lizzie's like, you know, screw that.
Yeah, I mean, Lady Catherine grills her. Her manner is so offensive that Lizzie's just dodging all of her questions and basically tells her, look, all your familial concerns, like, have nothing. Lady Catherine tells her she belongs to a different sphere of society, etc. But when Lizzie's finally tired, she finally does admit, no, I'm not engaged. But when asked if she'll never enter into such an engagement, she says, I will make no promise of the kind.
Yes, and, you know, says something to the effect of, you have insulted me in every possible way and must have nothing further to say. And then Lady Catherine's like, I am most displeased.
And then she leaves.
And one thing that was interesting, I didn't watch, obviously, the whole thing, but I did watch a clip of the Lady Catherine confrontation from the 40s, you know, black and white adaptation.
Huh. Okay.
And they departed from it, from the book, dramatically, because Lady Catherine doesn't get any, like, sort of redemptive, like, oh, I misjudged you, you know, whatever, at all in the book. But in that version, it says that she's, like, threatening to cut off Darcy, and then she leaves, and then Darcy's there, and, you know, Lady Catherine says to Darcy, like, you need someone who can challenge you, and this is her.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so I don't know why they would make that decision. Certainly no one's made that decision in the more recent, like, adaptations, but I thought, that's weird.
That is weird. I wonder why that is. Just they wanted to show more respect for, like, the great families, maybe, of the time.
I don't know. There were, like, only with my other podcasts and talking about, like, adaptations of other pieces of literature, particularly Gothic, that apparently there was a lot of censure in terms of, like, morality. Like, you couldn't, like, a bad guy couldn't go unpunished, like, in the 40s and 50s. So, like, there was a lot of weird things that they monitored in regards to what the moral of the story was saying. So I wonder if it had anything to do with that.
Maybe. I mean, it's kind of like, I mean, separately, Dave and my husband and I are, what, you know, listening to a podcast that's talking about a cartoon show. And, you know, in a lot of cartoons,
Avatar The Last Airbender.
Well, yeah, that's the one we're listening to. But just in general, in cartoons, you, like, can't show people punching other people and that sort of thing. So maybe that's, like, the 40s version of only being able to show certain things on screen.
And so Darcy gets wind of this confrontation and realizes that all is not lost with Lizzie, and so he goes back and proposes to her, and she says yes.
Yes, so what's funny is Lady Catherine relates, like, all of this conversation to her nephew. And because, you know, and tells how obstinate Lizzie was and not wanting to answer any questions. And because of this, this gives Darcy hope, because he's like, if she hated me, she would have outright said so. So there must be something here. So that's his reasoning for going to her. And, you know, we didn't talk about the differences in some of the movies, but in the 2005 version, there's a lot of very kind of very visually nice different scenes in the way they do this. Like the first proposal scene, you know, it's like raining and stuff and they're outside. Most of the in the book, you know, they're like inside. And then here in the 2005 adaptation, we get this really long drawn out walk, you know, Mr. Darcy's walking from Netherfield, supposedly, like in like his night stuff and like a night robe. And apparently this is supposed to be a nod to the Colin Firth scene. You know, it's like this, it's this adaptation's like Darcy not fully attired scene, I guess.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, in the book they're just on a walk or something. And, you know, he says, I mean, she like thanks him profusely for all his help and what he's done for Lydia, and he says, you know, obviously I did it all for you, please tell me, have your feelings changed at all? She awkwardly explains just how differently she thinks of him now. So yeah, I mean, the conversation goes on, but you know, basically he says he learned good principles growing up, but was still kind of spoiled and grew up kind of proud. His man, he apologizes, like he feels bad about his manners. Even the letter he wrote, he's saying like he feels kind of like some of it was not worded in the best fashion. But I mean, she also feels bad for assuming things about him, so, you know, they make up and they're obviously going to get married. When Lizzie tells Jane that she's engaged to Mr. Darcy, Jane doesn't believe her at all at first.
And then she gets called into her father's study and to be like, Mr. Darcy has just been here asking for your hand.
Yeah, and again, this is where Mr. Bennet probably gives some of the most useful advice in the book, which is, you know, are you sure about this? But, you know, Lizzie, you know, tells him that she is. She loves him. She was wrong about his character. Also, he's done this very good thing for our family. So yeah, and I mean, that's pretty much close to the end. I do like there's a comment here from Mr. Bennet, or it's more towards the end of the book, but he says something like, oh, I do love all my new son-in-laws, but Wickham is definitely my favorite. Like, jokingly.
Oh, dear.
And then there's just really a wrap-up with some of the characters, you know, in, like, Lady Catherine, you know, eventually is a visitor at Pemberley, and Kitty improves a little bit, and because she visits them from time to time, and...
And Mary becomes less sanctimonious.
Yeah, and Bingley and Jane kind of move in nearby, like, to where Pemberley is, and yeah, and everyone's just happily ever after, except for Caroline Bingley.
Yeah, poor Caroline. Alrighty then. Yes, that is Pride and Prejudice. Oh dear. So we can move on to our heroines of the ages, where we just have to name a couple female protagonists, whether in books, movies, media, whatever, that kind of remind us of our protagonist, Lizzie Bennet. Do you want to go first?
Sure. I mean, since we're already at so long here, I don't want to spend too much time, but I mean, there's an obvious comparison here for the Bennet sisters, and the Dashwood sisters from the previous book.
Right.
We have, one sister who's a little bit more adventurous, and I guess maybe romantic, although I wouldn't call Lizzie like super romantic. And then you have another sister who's much more calm and reserved. But I mean, there's still differences between the sisters themselves. I mean, so that's one comparison. Another comparison, well, I guess a couple more. So Elizabeth and Darcy, I think the reason this romance is admired a lot or is popular is it's kind of a Beauty and the Beast type of situation.
Or enemies to lovers, sort of thing.
I mean, it's Darcy is basically kind of it's there's a bit of a rebirth or redemption sort of arc here where his character changes. I mean, her character changes too in that she learns to like know more about him. So I mean, I think Beauty and the Beast is a very, very popular kind of story, and that's kind of embedded in this book. And then the only other thing is you mentioned it earlier, but if this was told from Mr. Bennet's point of view, Fiddler on the Roof.
Of course.
He has five daughters and, Tevye, he's more concerned with other things in life. Although he does care about his daughter's happiness and his, Golda is just extremely concerned with marrying off.
Right.
So those were the best comparisons I could think of. What about you?
Yeah, so I got, of course, I did Fiddler on the Roof to Sidle. Like, she's rebelling against her family's typical norms, but not in a super disrespectful way, like the younger sisters will. So I also thought of Jane Eyre. Just made me think of, Jane Eyre, again, having this, just sort of independence that she would rather, work as a living rather than automatically enter into a marriage, no matter how grand or how, modest. Like, she just decides, no, I'm not gonna do that unless I really, really like them.
Yeah, I mean, that's again kind of a bit of a Beauty and the Beast thing going on.
Of course, with Rochester.
Yeah.
And then my more modern example was Odette from Swan Princess.
Oh, I'm trying to remember that plot.
Just because Derek tries to propose to Odette in the beginning for, again, for really superficial reasons, and she's like, no.
Oh, that's right. She does. So, like, rejecting him until he, like, improves his,
Yeah, until he, improves his view on the world.
Right, himself.
Right. So yeah, those were my examples.
Okay.
Yeah. And now we move on to the Austenometer, where we rank on 1 to 10 for five categories of how Austen-y Pride and Prejudice is, which I'm assuming it'll be pretty high because I think this meter was heavily dictated by Pride and Prejudice because that is considered the template.
Yeah, this probably is the most Austen-y book.
Yeah. So yeah, category number one, Charming Rake.
Yeah, definitely 10. I think I'm trying to remember for Willoughby. I think I scored him at a 9 because in the end he did feel a little bit bad about what he did, but he still scored high because of what he did. Wickham is probably an all-out 10. I don't think he feels bad about anything he's done.
Yep. And then yeah, me too. I rank him at 10. And then Obligatory Clergyman. What do you think? Scale of 1 to 10?
Oh my gosh, probably also a 10. Mr. Collins is a very prominent presence in this book, not just as Liz a suitor for Lizzie and like the heir. Like, he doesn't just come, get rejected, and leave. We keep seeing him when she goes to visit Charlotte. Like, Mr. Collins is still there talking to them, throwing this like middle class lifestyle in her face. Definitely a 10.
Of course, yeah, me too. 10. Yeah, I'm not being very original here. Category number three, regrets and bad decisions.
I'm actually going to score this pretty low because even though Lizzie and even Darcy feel kind of bad about how they behaved in some situations, like Lizzie, I don't think really regrets like rejecting him. Like, she feels bad that maybe she didn't treat him as well, but she doesn't feel bad about not marrying him at first. So, and Darcy again feels bad about maybe some of his manners, but I mean, he was in the right to, like, he stopped Wickham. He helped Lydia. Like, he did a lot of things right that I don't think he has any regrets about, obviously. And then, like, the other people in the, I mean, Lydia is too thoughtless to have any regrets. So, I don't know, maybe four?
Yeah, although I'm going to be slightly more generous. I'm going to give it a 7 because, again, like, both Lizzie and Darcy have things they're right about and have things that they're wrong about. And, like, especially in the big proposal scene, that they're very, even though they're realizing maybe they got something wrong, they're still pretty adamant about the one thing that they did get right. So for that, I'm giving it a 7.
Okay.
Category number 4. Wealth as poetic justice.
Oh, I think this is also why this story is more popular than Sense and Sensibility. Both sisters marry very well, which made Caroline Bingley and Lady Catherine very put out. So it's definitely a rags to riches kind of story, which is a thing that people really, really enjoy. So 10.
For all those reasons, I give it a 9 because, again, it's a stark contrast to Sense and Sensibility, where even the daughter that marries better, Colonel Brandon, is only at 2,000 a year. And then Edward just has nothing and is like the curate now. Alrighty then, category number 5, feminism. What do you think?
I'm gonna rate it high. I know that this is actually a bit of a controversial topic. You know, people who are like actual literary critics and whatnot can point out problems with it. You know, I mean, we're working in an era here where women don't have power, right? So, I mean, you know, it's sort of like taking into consideration the context of the story. But what I'll say is I think because Lizzie refused Mr. Collins, refused Mr. Darcy, and then was, like, stood her ground when Lady Catherine was questioning her, like, I think there's just a lot of promotion of, you know, women's independence. And even in weird ways, like, a promotion for women's just mental and physical space. Like, Charlotte has her own room for her particular use. Letters, in a way, this is like getting into something I read, but letters, in a way, give you space to sort of peruse them and understand them and come to your own conclusions. So I'd say a 10.
Yeah, for me, you said all the things that you said is true, and certainly Lizzie is someone who stands up for herself and asserts herself. But again, in the beginning, I was just so put off by the fact that we have to make all the other women, like in her family, her mother and her sisters, that we have to make them either silly or make them like naive, like in Jane's case, even though she's nice and we don't give her the wisdom that she's typically due. But yeah, for all those reasons, I felt like even though in actions, Lizzie is portraying a lot of, you know, progressive feminist qualities, like the overall commentary of propping Lizzie up compared to everyone else, like I don't like that part. So I'm gonna be a 6 just because I'll probably, I don't know, that was just my personal vibe and reading, especially after reading Sense and Sensibility.
Yeah, I actually get that. I mean, I already gave my score, but I think if you'd ask me again after hearing that, I was mainly thinking about Lizzie as the protagonist. Yeah, I didn't even really consider like some of the other female characters and how they're portrayed. But yeah, I see your points.
Yeah, so you gave it 44 out of 50, and I'm trying to tally up mine, and mine is 42 out of 50.
That's probably the highest any book is going to score.
Probably, because again, like in creating the template, everyone goes back to Pride and Prejudice and what was notable about Pride and Prejudice. Wickham, Mr. Collins, you know, the fact that, you know, because they can have their emotional growth, they're rewarded with wealthy husbands, yada, yada, yada.
Mm-hmm.
All righty, then, that is it for Pride and Prejudice. You know, thank you so much for tuning in. Make sure to listen in next time where we discuss a piece of Jane Austen's work that is kind of, in my opinion, a little underrated. And that is Mansfield Park.
I agree. I think it'll be a shorter podcast, but it's definitely a longer book. So I have to get started.
Yeah, it is a longer book. I half read it, half listened to it on audiobook. And yeah, again, I want to refrain from doing my rankings until like the end of this series. But according to the last time I read Austen books, like Mansfield Park was in my top three.
Really?
Alrighty then. Well, thank you so much, everyone. Make sure to tune in for Mansfield Park in 2 weeks' time. Bye.
Bye.